Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22. 22 minutes of interviews with scientists mixed in with some great music. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, Planet Saturn in the Night Sky, Bee Sting Therapy, Life in the Arctic, and Designs Inspired by Nature. Here's a scientist soundbite.
People should know that the Arctic is not just that white spot that you see on a map at the top of the world. This is a crucial part of what makes the world what it is, both polar areas. This is a part of the planet that is vital to the way the planet functions, and all of us, everyone, wherever on the planet you live, you have a vested interest in what happens there.
You're listening to oceanographer and renowned diver, Sylvia Earle, an explorer in residence at National Geographic. She was part of a commission put together by the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. It looked at future change in the polar Arctic, rapidly being transformed by development and by melting permafrost and sea ice from climate change. Dr. Earle, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be on board.
Dr. Earle, what would you say is the main finding of the Shared Future Report by the Aspen Institute Commission on Arctic Climate Change?
I think the finding underscores the opportunity that now exists as never before, because never before have we known the risks. Never before have we understood the impacts that the Arctic has on the world as a whole, as a driver of climate, of such broad issues as sea level rise, the state of the world. It has a disproportionate impact on the world, given its relatively small size. It's crucial to many things, including the people who live there, the creatures who are at home there. This is a moment in history when we will take actions one way or the other, or inactions, but we humans will influence much that determines the fate, the future of the Arctic, the people, and the creatures who live there, and in so doing, with a global impact on all people everywhere.
What is the future that we all share in the Arctic?
Well, the Arctic, as a place that historically has, during all human preceding human history, has largely been an icy realm with an impact on currents that in turn influences the temperature of the planet, now vulnerable because of the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, with a rate of melting that is stunning. 2007 was a year that just rocked the community of scientists who were observing this, when the amount of summer ice had disappeared, plummeted at a rate that was unpredicted, unanticipated. And during the years since, it has continued to decline, not quite such a startling drop as between 2006, 2007, but the trend itself is accelerating, and that, for the people of the world looking at what's happening, it's an indication of how the planet is changing as a whole. The temperature rise in the Arctic is noticed faster than it is elsewhere. The feedback mechanisms, the decline of the ice means more dark water, which means that the impact of the warming is causing the melting to go even faster. A new transportation route across the top of the world is anticipated, not 1,000 years from now, not 100 years from now, but before this century is over. We don't know exactly when. The far-out projections are now being realized as closer to the present time. The impact for the people who live there, who, like the bears, like the seals, like the fish, like the under-ocean communities of life, all of this represents unprecedented change in a short period of time. Now, change is inevitable through all times, every day. Every day is different. The processes heretofore have been moving at a more stately pace, sort of a geologic pace. But the human influence on the atmosphere, on the ocean, on wildlife generally, we're now feeling this or seeing this, an accelerated change that we have to adjust to. And that's how it impacts not just the people of the Arctic, not just the people of the Northern Hemisphere, but the globe as a whole is changing. And we see it with clarity in the Arctic. And what happens in the Arctic affects the whole world.
The Shared Future Report highlights the importance of something called marine spatial planning. What is that, and why is that important in the Arctic?
Well, the Arctic is an ocean. That comes as big news to some people. I've known it for a very long time that the Southern Pole is a continent surrounded by ocean. The North Pole is an ocean, or northern waters. It's an ocean surrounded by land, basically. So it's entirely fitting that this come under the current theme of ocean spatial planning. How do we use this space? How do we protect it? How do we ensure that the value that we derive, a so-called free service from the Arctic Ocean to all people everywhere, is maintained and protected while the new demands, the new pressures to extract from it, to use it in other ways for shipping, for the extraction of ocean wildlife, the fish and other creatures that are marketable and therefore being viewed eagerly by countries who want to go fishing there, the potential for extraction of fossil fuels from beneath what is now ice-covered but soon will not be, or that even the ice-covered areas may be the source of sites for extraction of fossil fuels. There are great concern about, first of all, where it is, how to recover it, and if it is, in fact, going to be something that will be in the best interests of humankind everywhere to target these sources, given the risks that are associated with the extraction of fossil fuels, oil and gas, from the Arctic.
You've been listening to oceanographer Sylvia Earle. Stay tuned. Later, we'll talk to Deborah Bird about the best time of the year to see planet Saturn. Here's a song from Austin Music Awards Band of the Year, The Bright Light Social Hour. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Ryan Britton is here with a story of weird science from the frontiers of medicine. Imagine letting yourself be stung by a honeybee, perhaps hundreds of times a week, to help manage a disease. Ryan, tell us about this.
So I heard the story of a woman who, she refers to herself as Pat the Bee Lady, and she has multiple sclerosis, or MS. So there's no known cure for MS, but Pat the Bee Lady, her actual name is Pat Wagner, has managed to find something that helps her manage her disease, and that's having herself stung a couple hundred times each week by honeybees. Her husband is now, you know, to support this treatment, is a part-time beekeeper, and he's lovingly referred to as Stingray.
Is that his actual name, Ray?
Yep. Good old Stingray and Pat the Bee Lady.
So, Ryan, I'm curious, how does this all work? Why would Pat even try bee stings as a therapy for MS?
Well, the therapy is part of what's called apitherapy, and in this specific case, it's bee venom therapy, and that's been around for thousands of years and can be traced back to ancient Egypt, Greece, China, and there are references to connect bee stings helping rheumatism back in the 1800s, so Pat decided to give it a go and let one bee sting her on her left knee, and her left leg felt better from the MS, so she had several more, and you know, it's worked for her.
Has bee sting therapy worked for others with multiple sclerosis?
It has, although it should be said that medical studies that have been done to test the results of bee stings and MS have been mixed at best. Some studies have concluded that there's no benefit, but some MS sufferers, like Pat the Bee Lady, they swear by it. So we're not sure. I just thought it was kind of weird.
And I'm not sure I'm going to... I would recommend experimenting with bee stings. I wouldn't do it myself. Especially hundreds of bee stings if I don't have to. So, Ryan, where can people find out more about bee sting therapy?
You can find more on scienceblogs.com. There's also a video on bee sting therapy at National Geographic's YouTube channel. That's at youtube.com.
Weird Science with Ryan Britton. Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky and about sky watching Saturn. Deborah, welcome.
Hi, Jorge. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. So what's happening with Saturn this month?
Well, we are coming into the month of April 2011, and that is the best month in all of 2011 to see the beautiful ringed planet Saturn. And what's happening is that in early April, the Earth passes between Saturn and the Sun. And this is something that we do every year. Earth takes a year to go around the Sun. Saturn takes 30 years to go around the Sun. So Saturn is like a really slow runner on a track, and Earth is like a really fast runner. And we're just zipping around and around and around the Sun while Saturn's going very, very slowly. So once a year, we pass between Saturn and the Sun, and that is happening in April 2011.
So can you give us some tips on how to catch Saturn in the night sky?
Well, when we go between Saturn and the Sun, you can picture that the Sun is on one side of us and Saturn is on the other side. So we're lapping Saturn, basically. So the Sun is on one side, Saturn's on the other side. So when the Sun goes down at sunset and is in the west, that means Saturn has to be in the east. So just after sunset, as the Sun is sinking below your western horizon, Saturn's going to be rising up in your eastern sky. And Saturn is the faintest of the bright planets, but it's very noticeable for its golden color. It's a beautiful golden color, and it doesn't twinkle as the stars do. In 2011, Saturn is going to be in the constellation Virgo. And it's going to be very near Virgo's brightest star, which is called Spica. So in April of 2011, as you're standing there looking toward the eastern sky after sunset, say an hour after sunset, and you're thinking, gee, how far is the Sun below my horizon? That's how far above the horizon I'm going to look for Saturn. So you're going to be looking, you know, in the eastern sky a little way up, and you'll see two bright objects there. The golden one will be Saturn. It's higher in the sky. And the one that's a little bit lower in the sky and not so golden looking and twinkling more will be the star Spica.
Awesome. So that's Saturn and Spica in the night sky. And I'm Deborah. So just to go back one second here, and maybe you could explain for us, you started out telling us that this is the best time of year to see Saturn. Why is that?
Well, when we go between Saturn and the Sun, the distance between Earth and Saturn is at its least. And Saturn's brightness doesn't change that much throughout the year, but around the time we go between it and the Sun, it does get noticeably brighter. And if you were looking at Saturn through a telescope now, this would be the best time to see it because it's at its closest to us for the year. So that it's generally at its closest in early April, but throughout all of April 2011, Saturn's going to be in a very good place to observe.
Awesome. And we have some really great pictures of Saturn and an article on give us 5 minutes and we'll tell you everything we need to know about Saturn. Deborah, any last words on Saturn today?
That's right. Come to earthsky.org and you will find charts of how to see Saturn, especially around mid-April 2011. Saturn is going to be near the full moon in the sky. So April 15, 16, 17, you'll see Saturn near the very bright and nearly full moon.
Awesome. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. That was a song called To Modern Science by Austin's The Black and White Years. Check out their new video at earthsky.org. Beth Lebwohl joins us now with a story on biomimicry designs inspired by nature.
Hey, thank you so much, Jorge.
Yeah, Beth, what's happening?
Well, I spoke to Sunny Robertson, who is a senior educator at the San Diego Zoo. And I asked her about specific examples of biomimicry, particular instances in which design has actually been inspired by nature. And she said, well, here, Beth, is the quintessential example. In the early 90s, the Japanese had bullet trains. They still have those bullet trains. But their bullet trains were encountering a problem. When they would rush into tunnels, I believe at around 300 kilometers an hour, the air would pop out the back of the tunnel because of the force of the train's entry. And it was the design of the train that was causing that air to pop out the back. It was extremely disturbing to both the local community and the local wildlife. So engineers had to work on the problem. And it turns out that one of the engineers was a bird watcher, and the rest is history.
One of the engineers on the team was a bird watcher, and in his experience, he had actually witnessed the kingfisher bird diving down, from a tree branch through the air and going into the water, creating very little splash. And so he sort of recognized that same principle. Here's this bird moving from, a lower density area with all this free air, going into the water, which had a lot of density, and yet it didn't create a big disturbance. As the bird entered the water, very little disturbance, very little splash. So he thought, I wonder if I could apply this principle to the shape of the front of the bullet train. Because again, the train, just like the bird, was moving from low density into that, that tunnel where the air was all packed in. And so they did model the front of the train like the kingfisher face. It's got a pointy part to it, just like the beak of the kingfisher. And sure enough, when they tried out that new model, it moved through that tunnel without creating the boom, and also saved them 10 to 15% more energy because it was more aerodynamic.
Well, Beth, that was an example of biomimicry back from the 1990s. What about today?
Well, Sunny Robertson actually described another example of biomimicry, rather of current biomimicry research, this one involving snakes.
We really can learn a lot from them, and scientists have recently discovered that the way the snake senses heat is it has little receptors. So we're talking at the molecular level, little receptors that actually sense body heat. Now, the interesting thing is you and I, all humans, have the very same receptor in our tongues, in other parts of our body. And they call it the wasabi receptor. Essentially, that receptor is telling your body, yikes, be careful, don't eat too much of this. This could possibly be irritating. And in the snake, that same receptor tells them, ooh, something warm is coming by. So the reason this is interesting to scientists is because they've started to see that if we can understand the mechanism on how the snake's receptor works, because a snake is a much more simple animal than a human, maybe we can understand how to block those signals coming from the receptor. So for example, if a human is feeling something uncomfortable and stop some sort of pain or unpleasant experience.
Bullet trains with beaks, pain medicine from snakes, great examples of biomimicry. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. That's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Bright Light Social Hour, The Black and White Years, Box of Baby Birds, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. To take us out, Austin Music Awards Song of the Year. It's called Detroit by The Bright Light Social Hour.